Greetings, and welcome to another Fireside Chat. I am your host, Lance White. I'm delighted to have a returning guest this evening. Her name is Helen Littrell. Helen wrote a groundbreaking book called Rachel's Eyes. This is her own story about her daughter, Marissa, who lived with an odd college roommate named Rachel. Marissa was legally blind, needing assistance, and Rachel had no history, a strange diet, and many unanswered questions. Marissa's story invites us to expand our vision in order to see the world through the eyes of a blind girl, her mother, and most strangely, through Rachel's eyes. So let's welcome Helen to the show and find out more about this mysterious story. Hi, Helen. How are you?
Hi, Lance. I'm so glad to be talking to you.
It's good to be here talking to you again, too. Has anything unusual happened since our last conversation on air?
I don't think so. Let's see, that was right after the first of the year, wasn't it?
Yes, it was in January.
Right. Well, I think that I've had one abduction since then, but I don't recall any details. It's kind of the same as usual. I know when it's going to happen, and because it's always the same, but I never recall any details. And that bothers me. If I'm going to be going someplace off the Earth's surface, I want to know what happens.
Right. I agree. What are the sensations before that happens?
Well, it usually happens after I've been in bed for a while, and it's maybe around sometime after midnight, maybe 2 o'clock or so. And I'll wake up and see a really bright light coming from over a big pine tree that's right outside my bedroom window. And I always get up and stand at the window and look up to see if I can see where the light is coming from, and I never can because the tree is so tall. The light, the source, is above the top of the tree, apparently. And then I look at it there for a couple of minutes, and then I go back to bed. And I think I go to sleep. Now, that doesn't make any sense, and then in the morning, I always wake up with the same symptoms, and sometimes they're more severe than others, and I do know that I've been taken.
What are the symptoms like?
Well, actually, I feel like I've been sort of beat up or something. I just feel as if I've really been roughed up, and I'm extremely exhausted, and I have a headache that starts right in the middle of my forehead, and, and I don't have headaches normally at all, and this is a really severe one, and then I have this extreme thirst for orange juice. And I know this sounds really kind of goofy, but and I can't concentrate either for almost the entire day, and I'm just so overwhelmingly exhausted. And normally I sleep, you know, like anyone else. Sometimes you feel better than others, but you never feel totally exhausted.
No, not at all, not at all. Have you found that there are that other people who have a history of being abducted have similar experiences?
Sort of, especially seeing the light beforehand.
And
it's not always, of course, at the above a tree outside their window like mine is. Sometimes it's in their room, their bedroom, or down the hall or something. But then they always do weird things like I do. They look at it, and then they go back to bed. So they think. And I don't know, maybe I do go back to bed, but I believe that I'm taken out really shortly afterwards. Or I never do lay down again, and, you know, I'm the memory is planted in my mind that I went back to bed.
Because that's a common experience, isn't it?
I believe it is.
Yeah.
I've heard a lot of people talk about that, and they're all just as confused as I am. They say, well, why would we do that?
Yeah.
You know, why would we just say, oh, well, you know, because that's not a normal thing to have happen, this light, and it's an unusual light, too. It's bright, and yet it's a soft light. It's not like any other light that I've ever seen.
Huh.
And other people have said the same thing, and it's really hard to describe it because it is bright, and it sort of shimmers just a little tiny bit, not a lot. But everybody seems to say the same thing.
It's too bad that you, well, maybe it's not too bad that you can't remember.
Well, yeah, there may be a good reason.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, this has happened quite a few times over the years, and one time when it happened, though, the next morning when I woke up, I had these same feelings of just being beat up, but that time I think I really was, because when I knew I just hurt all over.
Uh-huh.
And I know what a beat-up feeling is, because in my marriages I've underwent that quite a few times, so
uh-huh.
So I know what that's like. But when I got out of bed this one time, my right shoulder was dislocated.
Really?
And, you know, it would be really hard to sleep in such a position that you dislocate your shoulder.
Yes, yes.
And I talked to my regression therapist, June Steiner, who did the regressions on me for the book. I talked to her about it because I was really concerned. I couldn't think what would have happened
uh-huh.
to cause that. It never had before. And she said, well, you might want to consider what they call MILAB, the military abduction.
Oh.
And I don't know, because it began the same way as the other ones had, you know, the light over the tree, and I looked at it and went back to bed. But that was the first time that I had ever had a problem like that, and
huh.
It was dislocated. It was very painful for quite a long while.
Maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that. I know that I've heard that the military does do their form of an abduction. Are you familiar with that? What did she say about military abductions?
What did June say?
Yeah.
Well, she didn't go into any detail, but she said, I believe that she's worked with other people who definitely know for sure that they've had that type. She thought it might be, that was, I believe it was right after the book came out.
Oh.
And she said it might have something to do with that, and yet she said that didn't make a lot of sense to do that to me after the book came out. She said it if they were going to do it, they really should have done it before it
yeah.
was published, and then maybe I could do something to stop it.
Huh.
But, of course, she isn't sure that that's what happened,
right,
and neither
right.
am I. I am really positive what happened, I mean, extended the injury. But I've heard about cases where that has happened when they wanted to intimidate someone
uh-huh.
and possibly, we'll say they were going to come out with a book and they had an abduction where they were messed up in one way or another, it
yeah.
roughed up, and it would cause them to say, well, they didn't want to go any further with their project, or even sometimes to say, well, they lied about it in the first place.
Well, let's find out a little bit more about the story about your daughter Marissa and her experiences with Rachel. And it seems that you eventually found out that your whole family has had experiences with abductions. Is that true?
Yes. Most of them have. And I didn't find that out until the book came out or about the same time.
Uh-huh.
But actually, my boys have both had experiences. And they don't want to talk about it. They're really close-mouthed about it.
Yeah.
I think it's too painful, maybe, or they think it will be too painful if they start talking about it and start recalling facts.
Yeah, yeah.
But they both have, and in fact, the woman who I always thought was my aunt, and then later I found out was my real mother, had told me, after I found out my birth situation there, she told me that when she was a child, and they lived way back in the country, it was in upper New York State, away from any air bases or towns of any size or anything, and they would, at night, in the middle of the night, they would feel this rumble and feel like vibrations or something, and her mother, which was my grandmother, would get all the kids up and get them dressed, and there was 8 or 9 kids, there was a whole lot of them, and they would all get dressed and go outside, and they would look at the ships.
Wow.
And I was just amazed when she told me that, because she volunteered it.
Huh.
And she didn't know that I had written the book.
Wow.
And because I asked her, after I found out, you know, about my origin, I asked her, well, was there ever anything strange in your childhood that, you know, about the kids or anything? And she started right out with that. Well, you know, we would get all, everyone would get up and dressed. And that was what surprised me, because normally you wouldn't get dressed to go outside and look at something.
Yeah, yeah.
But, of course, it could have been in the winter time too, and there's a lot of snow and everything, but still, you would just throw a coat on.
Huh. I bet she could have told some interesting stories.
I think she could, and I pressed her for it. And she said, well, she didn't want to talk about anything more than that. She said, I can't remember. It was so long ago.
Yeah.
And I said, well, yes, it was a long time ago, but you remembered really well up to this point. And I said, you know, maybe if you just think a few minutes, it would come back to you. No, I don't want to talk about it. So I think that they may have gone for a ride in the ship.
Yeah, that's what it sounds like.
But I don't know. You know, that's conjecture.
Well, maybe you could tell us a little bit about the story that you wrote about Rachel and how that came about. What with Marissa?
How they met each other?
Yes. How did that begin?
Well, that began in the spring of 1972 in a town in Northern California. And my daughter had left home, and she had an apartment, and she couldn't really manage it financially, and so she was looking for a roommate. And sort of almost instantly, like the next day after she began looking, this man showed up, military man, with his daughter. And this was in the counselor's office, because the counselor was helping her to secure a roommate, because my daughter was blind and it was hard for her to do things. And so they got along immediately. They liked each other. And it seemed that Rachel needed someone who wasn't going to be too critical of some of her ways, which were a little strange, because her father said, and this was Colonel Nadine, said that she had been raised on a base, really remote, and there weren't any other teenagers around. And my daughter needed someone that could sort of help her, because she wasn't very much, very sighted at that time. She could see just little tiny glimpses, but not much. And so she needed someone to help her with her personal things and help with the money. The rent and utilities and that. So that was how they got together. It was, as I look back on it now, it seems as though it was one of those things that may have been orchestrated.
Yes, I call those setups.
Yeah, that's the regular name for them.
Yeah. It does seem that we often have times in our lives when everything just goes a certain way. It's almost like following a movie script that's so perfectly written, and you just can't do anything but follow your lines.
That's it. And sometimes, it seems to me, we go along and we don't even have any lines that we know of.
Uh-huh.
But there are some, I guess, that we're following, and these synchronicities are just, you know, it has to be orchestrated by somebody.
Oh, yes. Yes.
It has to.
You mean somebody beyond the earth plane.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I agree.
I really do.
I agree. I agree totally. So this girl, Rachel, was the odd one, and she moves in with your daughter, Marissa, who's legally blind. Was Marissa able to see, what did she think about Rachel, and what were her, you know, when did you start first find about out about her roommate?
Well, I began to get phone calls from my daughter that the roommate spoke sort of strangely. She didn't, she spoke mechanically, and she didn't use any contractions like don't or didn't or anything like that. And she seemed to have a really limited fund of knowledge for a teenager. And she hadn't ever been out on a date, and she didn't know anything about the music of the time, of the early 70s. And all kids knew about that.
Oh, yeah.
To some extent, you
yeah.
know. And she just seemed terribly naive. And then she couldn't eat regular food or drink regular water or sodas or anything like that. Her food arrived outside of the apartment in little boxes, like those boxes that peas and corn used to come in, the bird's eye, you know, tight little square boxes. but what was in it looked like sort of like spinach, and Sharon or Marisa did get a look at that. A little glimpse of it, what she could see, and that's what she told me it looked like, warmed over spinach about 3 or 4 times.
Huh.
And she asked if she could take a bite of it, and Rachel said, no, you can't, because that would harm you, that would make you sick.
Huh.
So all of these things kind of begin to pile up on my daughter, you know, and her mind, and so she was telling me about them. And I stopped by one day to see my daughter, and I met Rachel face-to-face, and that was when I first realized that she really wasn't probably from here.
Meaning not from this planet.
That's right.
What were your first impressions of her?
Well, I had touched her arm. I don't remember if I talked about this the other time we talked. I had hoped to meet her this time I stopped to see my daughter, and she wasn't there. And just as I was getting ready to leave, we heard someone coming up the stairs.
Uh-huh.
And so I waited a minute, and my daughter said, I think it sounds like her. So I waited, and yes, it was. And she sort of rushed past me into the apartment just to stop long enough for my daughter to introduce us, and her response when Marissa said, well, Rachel, this is my mother, I want you to meet her, and Rachel said something like, I am very pleased to meet you,
huh.
Like that, and that wasn't quite normal, but anyway, I didn't pay that much attention. But when she came back out with something in her hand, she tripped over something on the rug just before she got to us. And I was standing on one side of the open doorway, and Marissa was on the other. And I could see that Rachel was going to fall right straight forward and fall right on her face.
Ooh.
And she didn't seem to be catching herself. And most people in that situation, you reach out your hands and grab for whatever is there. But she didn't. So I grabbed her arm, and as I did, her jumpsuit sleeve slipped up, and I was holding on to her arm, and the skin was kind of spongy and really cool feeling.
Huh.
Just felt artificial.
Huh.
And it was sort of like the skin on a doll that I'd had years and years when I was a young child.
Uh-huh.
And it had the skin that was supposed to feel real, but it didn't either. As I had a hold of Rachel's arm and stood her back up, she had sunglasses on, large wraparound sunglasses, and they slid down on her nose, and I found myself right almost nose-to-nose with her, looking into those eyes, and they were huge and kind of an avocado green.
Uh-huh.
And they had the vertical slits and regular pupils, and I was really kind of mesmerized, I guess. As I looked into her eyes, and I couldn't look away, and I was just terrified for a moment. And I stood there looking at her, and then I realized that she was more afraid than I was. I was getting a lot of thoughts going back and forth from her to me in those few seconds. She was more afraid than I was because she realized that I had seen that she wasn't what she was supposed to be.
Now, were you empathic at that point? I mean, were you accustomed to having situations where you could read people's minds or, you know, pick up impressions or things, or was this something that was fairly new?
It was fairly new. I had been in those situations where I should have picked up on things, but I really didn't. And as you mention it, I'm wondering why I didn't. But at any rate, I certainly was at that moment. And I have been from then on, and I'm getting more that way, too. But at that time, there was something else about Rachel, too, that my daughter had been telling me, that she always dressed in a jumpsuit with the long sleeves and the long legs, of course.
Uh-huh.
And she always wore a scarf tied around her head and these huge, big wraparound sunglasses inside and out. In the spring and summer, Northern California, that's not really a comfortable outfit to wear.
No, not at all.
It's a little bit hot.
Yeah.
But she still wore them, and I don't know whether my daughter questioned her about it or not. She never did mention that.
Huh. Interesting. Now, what did you find out about Rachel's adopted father, the Colonel Nedian?
Yes. Well, shortly after that episode where Rachel and I were face-to-face, the colonel had asked my daughter to set up a meeting, and he'd already talked to my daughter about it because he realized that she was concerned, too, because my daughter and I talked about it after Rachel went on back to across the street to the college that was right there. And so my daughter and I talked about it, and then my daughter did talk to Colonel Nadine, and he told her the whole thing. But then he said that he felt I should know, too, because I had that meeting, and he said anyone would wonder, you know, what was going on, and they would know that she was quite different. And he felt that since the two girls were getting along so well and everything, and I hadn't insisted my daughter move right out that episode, that I should know. And so we set up a meeting for a few days after that, and it was probably within 10 days of the original incident. And he sat me down in the apartment, and both girls were there, too.
Huh.
Rachel sat in her bedroom. The door was open, but she sat in on the bed.
Okay.
And my daughter sat on one end of the couch, and I sat on the other, and the colonel was in the chair. And he started to tell me, he started with his entrance into the Air Force and a little bit about his home life and everything.
Uh-huh.
And he talked maybe for 5 minutes, or maybe 10. But after that, I don't remember him talking anymore, and it wasn't more than a half hour or so that I spent in the apartment, and I had all of this information, and I had a monumental headache, too, because what I had was a big download of information, because he could communicate telepathically.
Wow. So not only Rachel, but also her adopted father, the colonel, could communicate telepathically.
Right, and I'm not sure whether he was an empath to begin with, or I think it was something that he learned in his training before he went to Four Corners. Because he was going to be coming in contact with different extraterrestrials, and they didn't all... Well, I think none of them probably spoke English, and he, of course, he'd be at a loss for whatever language they had, and so it was really necessary that, you know, they were telepathic, or that he was telepathic, I mean.
Did all of that information come through in that one meeting?
Yes.
Oh, really?
And, you know, little bits and pieces would surface from time to time. And actually, they not much of anything did until I decided to write the book. And that was after my daughter had passed away. And she and I had always talked about writing a book about Rachel. I don't know. Our lives got really crazy after that, hers and mine, and we kind of went in different directions physically. And we just never got around to doing it. And then after she passed away, I got to thinking about it, and it was after that I made the decision to do the book, that little pieces of it, of what the Colonel had told me, would start to come back. And it was quite a while before I could put them in any kind of order. And even then, it didn't all come back by any means. It was really after I started to have the regressions with Dr. Steiner that the missing pieces would come back. And I would be so surprised. I can remember, I don't know if you've ever been regressed, but it's an odd feeling. You know, you're sort of there on the couch or wherever, with part of your mind, but then you're wherever they take you to, whatever scene that you're at, under hypnosis. But I remember feeling so surprised. I'd think, because something would come out, she would ask a question, and I would give an answer, and it would surprise her too. but I can remember the surprise in my voice, and then after the session was over, I think, well, maybe that didn't really happen, that I was so surprised or whatever. But then I transcribed all of those sessions myself. And I heard the different emotions in my voice. I could see where it was way more of a lot of information than I had thought in the beginning when it was first downloaded to me.
Can you give some examples of some of the things that came out in those transcripts that surprised you?
Well, one of the things was actually back to Rachel, because Dr. Steiner took me back to that date when I met Rachel in the doorway.
Okay.
And I thought that she was just had been so brief when she said, "I'm pleased to meet you," or whatever. But actually, she had reached out her hand and like to shake hands, which she didn't do like a normal person. She just sort of put her hand out with the palm up. But I remembered looking then, and she only had four fingers.
Wow.
I did not remember that at all before. And then I started to cry during the session, and I was so horrified. But not at the four fingers, but at the fact that they didn't have any fingernails. And I could see that just as clearly as anything.
Wow. And yet when you were in that moment, for whatever reason, maybe it was Rachel able to project something or to distract you from noticing those things, you didn't see that.
No, I didn't see it at all.
Wow.
I was concentrating on how strange her voice sounded. which certainly was, enough to distract a person, but I had looked at her hands, and I looked close. I mean, how often do you look at a person's hand and pay that much attention to their fingernails?
Right.
But that was one instance.
That is unusual.
Yeah, that evoked quite a bit of emotion. And then there was another instance too, where I had gone to visit my daughter, and she was still at school or somewhere. She wasn't there, but Rachel was, and so I stood in the kitchen, and we were talking, and she stood, I stood with my back to the kitchen table, and I remember that came out really close, very clearly in the regression. It was an old kind of an oblong kitchen table. It was those old porcelain-topped ones. And it was really cool feeling on the top. And I stood there with my back to it, and I had one hand behind me on the table. And Rachel was about 4 feet away from me, or five, and she was by the refrigerator. And she started to talk, and she said that she wished that I could be her mother. And she was really sincere, well, as much as she could be, with not a whole lot of expression in her voice, but her words, you know, it sounded as though she truly meant it.
Uh-huh.
And I told her, well, no, I can't be. I can be your friend, but I can't be your mother.
Huh.
And she said, well, I wish you were my mother. And she said, you need to know some things. And so I said, well, maybe so. And she just kept staring at me. And all of a sudden, I found myself in a different location, and I'm not sure where it was. I think it was on a ship, probably.
Uh-huh.
And I was standing on the outside of a room that was completely surrounded by windows that began about waist high, and they went up to the ceiling.
Uh-huh.
And Rachel was on the inside of this room, and I was on the outside. And there were no doors or anything. And I wondered kind of briefly, how did she get in there? And she said to me, come in. And I said, I can't, because there's no door. And she says, you don't need a door.
Huh.
And she said, just put your hand on the window, and I'll put mine in the same place on the inside, and you can come right through.
Wow.
And so, I never questioning, I don't know why I don't question these things, but I didn't.
Uh-huh.
And I put my hand there, and then I found myself on the inside of the room. And she said, I want to show you something. So she took me into an inner room that also had windows all the way around it.
Uh-huh.
And all along the walls of this room were like aquariums or something. They looked like fish tanks. And there were rows of three high all the way around the room. So I don't know how many there were, but it was quite a few. And inside of these things were, inside of this, the tanks with kind of greenish, brackish-looking water fluid, there were fetuses in all different stages of development. And I was pretty horrified at that. There were just appalling looking. They didn't look human by any means.
Uh-huh.
And she said, we need you to help take care of these. And I said, I can't do that. I can't do that. I have a job, and I have to help Marissa. And she was really, really angry. She said, well, if you can't do that, and we will find something else for you to do. And then she didn't say anything for a minute. And I thought, God, could it be worse, you know? What could it be? And then she said, you will be an educator. And of course, I'm so practical, I said, why? I'm not a teacher. I have no credentials.
Uh-huh.
And she was really, really angry at this time. And she said, it does not matter. You will tell this story, and you will educate people. And she's talking in this really basic English that maybe a second grader should understand.
Uh-huh.
And so I didn't say anything, but I guess I must have acknowledged it somehow that, yes, I guess I could do that. And I thought, if I could just get out of here, I'm not going to, you know, keep my end of the bargain. But then it came time to go out, which was in a couple of minutes, and we went back out of this room and into the larger one, back through the window, the same way I got in.
Uh-huh.
With her hand, both of our hands together on the inside of the window, and we both went through at the same time. And then I found myself back in the kitchen.
Wow.
In the same position, with my hand still behind me on that cool porcelain top table.
Wow, so all of that took place in possibly in the matter of seconds.
It could have. It could have. I didn't, you know, actually I didn't pay any attention to what time I went in or what time I went out, but I really don't think that I was there more than maybe 15 minutes, or if that, because if my daughter wasn't there and then I had to go home, I couldn't wait around very long. But I have no idea the time element there, but I know I had quite a trip.
Wow, it sounds like it.
But talking about evoking emotion, you know, I felt quite wrung out after that experience. That was really...
Did you find out why Marissa seemed, why Rachel seemed to be so insistent that you participate in some way?
No, and I never pursued it. But okay. I've done a lot of thinking after, in the interim, you know, after I transcribed it, heard the emotion in my voice and everything. I'm thinking that I'd had quite a few miscarriages. And I'm thinking that maybe one or more of those could have been mine. I don't know. I hate to think that, but, you know, the truth of it is it really could have been.
Yes, absolutely.
It happens to many, many people.
Yes, it does. It's fairly widespread. And you know, when people don't question their experiences, then they just kind of write it off like it's a normal thing. Well, this happened, and that's all there is to it. But, you know, when they're allowed to regress or think about it more, if something triggers it, then there are unusual things that can kind of lead you in another direction.
Well, that's really true. And I think one of the reasons that people can't even allow themselves to think about the possibility is that it's really kind of horrific. I mean, these beings, the babies in the tanks, they don't look like anybody's idea of what a normal human baby is going to look like.
Huh.
They're like they're deformed or something, and we're brought up in a society where things are supposed to be pretty close to perfect.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, the babies are supposed to, well, they all look different, of course, but they all, even if they're premature, they still look like human babies.
Uh-huh.
Even the little ones that are born at maybe 4 or 5 months and pass, you know, right after they're born, but they still look like little miniature babies or humans, and these didn't look like that. They
what
had big eyes and big heads and no chins, and, you know, they, I think that is very difficult, and it has been for me, even now, as I'm talking, it's hard for me to sit here and tell you that maybe one or more of those was mine.
Huh.
But I've learned so much since I met Rachel, and a whole lot more that was in my head. At the time of the regressions, and it's come out, and I realized that none of this has really harmed me. I think people are afraid when they are considering accepting some of these facts for themselves.
Uh-huh.
I think they're afraid, well, what'll happen next? Well, nothing really has happened next that I know of. Certainly hasn't been harmful, except that one incident with the dislocated shoulder, but I don't think that had anything to do with hybrid fetuses.
Right, right.
You know, I don't think there's any connection at all there. So that's the only bad thing that's really happened to me. And yes, it was emotionally pretty traumatizing to undergo the regressions and put all the pieces together and connect the dots.
Right, right.
But you get over that and you realize, yes, now everything that I know happened then and then and then, now it all makes sense. And it really hasn't harmed me, and I don't think it's harmed anyone else to any great degree.
If anything, you probably wish you had more memories of it.
Oh, I do.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. There was, I spoke to one other person, his name is Jim Sparks, who is one of the few people who remembers all of his abductions over a period of many years. And And it's quite a quite another story, you know. But did the Colonel ever speak of the ET Earth hybrid program and how extensive or expansive it might be?
Not much as far as the extent, but while he was stationed there at Four Corners, which was down in southern Nevada, not too far from where Area 51 is now.
Uh-huh.
But at that time, I'd never heard of Area 51. And, well, I suppose it was there, but I hadn't heard of it.
Right, right.
And they had a program there. It was an exchange program with scientists from a different constellation. And they were there strictly working on scientific projects, but with cloning of blood and blood substitutes. And they were doing what, at that time, well, in the early 70s and probably before that, well, yes, it was before that, about different body parts like fingers and ears and internal organs and things. They were doing that, but, of course, no news of that came out until just the last couple of years or so with us. But some of those scientists that were in the exchange program, they were hybrids.
Huh.
So there was a hybrid program going on. But as far as the Colonel's function in it, he was pretty much restricted to just Rachel.
Yeah. Why do you think that he was allowed to be so open with Rachel? Do you think that was an experiment on the part of the military?
Yes, I do think so.
Mm-hmm.
You mean as far as telling me about it?
Yes, and having her actually come out into public and live with somebody that's, you know, because that's quite, that would be taking quite a chance, as secretive as they are.
Well, this is true, but sometimes they keep the secrets right out in broad daylight.
Right in front of you.
And in the 70s, college students were kind of dressing and acting strange.
Well, that's true. That's true.
And so she was, you know, quite a lot more extreme, but yet it could be passed off as just eccentric, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't understand, and I never have, why really that he felt obligated to tell me all of that, because he really didn't have to. I mean, he could have told me almost anything, you know, within reason, and I would have probably believed it.
Yeah.
But I did, at that time, I did have a top secret encrypto clearance that I had had back east, because I had needed it. I worked in the communication center back there, and, oh gosh, that was in the 50s. And then I got transferred out to California to another base near the college. And the funny thing was, and I never thought of it until I wrote the book and people started saying, well, why would he tell? How could he dare to tell you that? That was dangerous.
Right.
But my clearance was never lifted when I left back east, and it should have been. Should have been then, before I left. Because the job I went into here was just strictly supply, and then I worked as a packer, you know, and you don't need any clearance for that. But that's not a good enough reason either, that I had a high clearance.
Hmm.
Because he didn't tell me that I shouldn't talk to anyone else about this, but maybe he thought that the sheer, you know, just the amount of the kind of information he was giving me, who would I dare to tell it to?
Right, exactly.
I don't know that that was it, but I certainly didn't talk to anybody about it.
Yes, that would be the natural thing to do, I would think.
Yeah, you think, well, I can tell her this. People are just going to tell her she's nuts and ignore her, and, you know, so she's not going to say anything.
Right.
But that's not a very secure way of thinking on his part.
Yeah.
I really don't know.
How long did the two girls live together?
About 4 months.
Okay. And then Rachel, when did Rachel leave, and what were the circumstances under which she did leave?
Well, not too long after the disclosure by the colonel of all of this background information, and Rachel was really upset after that. I talked to her, and I told her, you know, it doesn't matter. Everybody's different. I said, look at Marissa. She's different.
Uh-huh.
I'm different. And her brothers are. Everybody is. It doesn't matter where you came from or any of this. It doesn't matter to me. But she was quite upset. And at any rate, one day, oh, probably 2 weeks after the colonel talked to me, my daughter came home for lunch. And by that time, she was seeing a little bit better. Not too well, but she could get around. And she only had to go across the street from the campus to the apartment building. So she came home expecting to find Rachel there, and there was no sign of her, and she called and called and no answer. So she went into Rachel's room, and none of her things were there.
Oh.
And it was a furnished apartment, so the bed and dresser and that was there, but none of her clothing or her things that she had, personal things, were there. And so my daughter was really, really upset. And then she looked again at the dresser, and there was a note stuck on it. And so she took the note off, and she sat down on the bed, and she read it, and it said something to the effect that, I'm sorry to leave and because you've been such a good friend, but I've left you a gift. And so she sat there for a minute, and she looked at the note again, and then it dawned on her she had read the note. At that time, she could see to read the note. And up until then, she had had to use a real strong magnifying glass to read anything, and she'd have to have her nose right down almost on it.
Uh-huh.
As that, and even at that, she didn't try even to read that way. She had someone to read her lessons to her, and she had a lot of the books were recorded and everything. But it dawned on her that the gift that Rachel had left was the gift of improved sight.
Wow.
And that fluctuated for quite a while, but it was quite a bit better. Even in the poor days, it was better than it ever had been before, since she started with blindness.
Wow, that's amazing.
It really was.
Yeah. Huh.
I know it sounds kind of like a fairy tale. But at any rate, my daughter called me and told me what had happened. And so I got in touch with a friend who was he was the chief of security there at that particular base. And he did owe me a couple of favors, so I had him check on the colonel to see if he was still around.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed that all of his files had mysteriously disappeared from this other base. And it was like he had never existed.
Wow.
But the friend knew that he had, because after I'd had my face-to-face encounter with Rachel, I was fairly upset then, so I had called this man then and asked him what he could find out about the colonel, and he corroborated everything. He had been stationed at Four Corners, and he was associated with what was called assigned to ATIC, and that at that time that stood for Aerospace Technical Information Command. Stands for something else now. It's close to it, but a little bit different. But my friend had told me that this initial checkup on the colonel revealed that that was his duty. He was out there at Four Corners, and he was working with this program with the exchange scientists and sometimes picking up the pieces when the crafts didn't land quite right and the occupants were killed or whatever. And so he was really amazed. The second time he did the checking, and there was no file, because he knew there was to begin with.
Now, in the book, we do find out what happens to Rachel. I know this is not the happiest part of the story, but can you tell us what you eventually found out about Rachel's life?
Well, she didn't come to a very happy ending, you're right. It seemed that she, after her disappearance, and I don't know where she went. I really don't know where the two of them went, if they went together or she was taken separately. But her purpose in this program, the Humanization Project, was to see to what degree she could acquire human emotions.
Uh-huh.
And she had acquired quite a few, because she showed that to me, and she certainly showed it to my daughter.
Uh-huh.
And to the different people that had become acquainted with her. And apparently she had acquired too much, and so they decided that instead of deprogramming her somewhat, they would just eliminate her. And which sounds reasonable according to how sometimes the government does things. And so she was pushed down a flight of stairs and died that way.
Wow.
And that was by military operatives. But it had to be agreed to by her father, too, which was a difficult thing for him. But he knew that going in.
Yeah.
That if she acquired too much, that had to happen.
Yeah.
And that came out in the regressions, too. I'd had glimpses of that before.
Uh-huh.
And just little tiny bits and pieces. But then not too long ago, sometime last fall, I had an abduction experience, at least I think that's what it was, and I was taken somewhere and shown that scene happening. And it was like I was a bystander, and it wasn't a dream either. It was real. Well, to whatever degree, I don't know.
Right.
It had to have taken me back in time, that's for sure. But I was standing off to one side at this top of the stairs, and two of these guys dressed in dark suits and everything had her between them. They took her to the top of the stairs, and they just really just kind of threw her down. And it was a long flight of stairs, and they were cement.
Huh.
And so I was allowed to see that.
Wow.
And I didn't like that. I didn't see why that was necessary, but maybe it was just to cement it further in my mind.
Yeah, yeah. Do you have any gut feeling about what the program was trying to, you know, what they're trying to do, if we're being upgraded, or if they're being upgraded, or both of us are they're trying experiments to see how we meld together for some reason?
Well, it's just a guess, but I'm beginning to think that maybe we are and they are both being upgraded. I have seen what are called, I guess, the indigo children or the star kids, or there's different names, or the crystal children. There's different names for them. I've seen two, it's one child. I've seen him twice. It's a little boy here in this town. And I've seen him in the same place, about the same time, and I don't know who his parents were, because I was just so kind of mesmerized by him that I don't know why I didn't look around to see who his parents were, but I'm a transcriptionist, and so I have to go pick up my work and deliver this old work every day. And I went into this clinic, and he stepped right out, and he should have been sitting to the side in the waiting room with his parents, but when I walked in, he walked right out and stood there to the side, he really got my attention, but his eyes just reached out and grabbed mine, and they were big and kind of violet colored. He was just unusual. His eyes were very large.
Huh.
And he was a good-looking little boy, but he didn't seem quite right. There was something that there was more than human to him in some way, and his eyes just locked on mine. I couldn't hardly look away, and then I thought, well, I better, you know, people are going to wonder what's going on here. So I broke the gaze and went on and dropped my things off and left. Well, about 2 weeks later, I walked in, same time of morning, and he was there again, and the same thing happened. And I don't know if he was downloading some information there or what, but he just picked me out. And,
wow.
You know, I'm not an unusual-looking person or anything to really catch anyone's attention.
Yeah.
Not really. And but it's like he knew me, and I knew him, and he was probably about 6 years old.
Wow.
5 or 6, very, very young boy. And then I've seen some adults here in town too, that I think are hybrids to whatever degree. But I think that it's a joint project. I think that some of them are coming in, the ones that look as if they can pass, reasonably. And I think they are trying to fit in.
Do you feel like these are special or accelerated times that we're living in?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I feel like I'm on a roller coaster sometimes. It's just, and they say, well, when you get older, time goes faster.
Uh-huh.
But that's not entirely true, because I hear the young kids saying that, too.
Yeah, yeah.
How many people are?
What do you think is happening? Do you think it's a shift in consciousness or a shift in our planet's vibration that's causing this?
I think it's both.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the vibrations are just accelerated.
Yeah.
It's just almost a palpable thing.
Yes, yeah.
At times, not always, but at times you can just feel it.
Yes, yes. Well, of course, a lot of people believe that this is a period of time when they call it either the ascension or the shift, or, you know, some people in more traditional faiths call it revelations.
Right.
But whatever the name is, you know, it's there's definitely something different happening.
Oh, there is.
We don't have a lot of time left, Helen. How can people find out more about your book, and where can they reach it or you?
Okay, they could order it from www.fifthworld.com, and that's 5thworld.com, or amazon.com.
Okay.
Or they could call Wildflower Press, and that is 1-800-366-0264. And if they'd like to contact me, I'd love to hear from anyone. And they can get me at Helen Fifth World at AOL.com, and that's Helen5thworld@AOL.com.
Wonderful. What would you like the listeners to know or be left with upon reading your story?
I would like them to know that if they've had unusual experiences like this, they should feel free to talk to someone who they can trust. But you can't just talk to anyone, but you need to seek out someone that they can trust, like you and like me.
And
in that case, if they'd like to email me, I would be so happy to talk to them. And maybe they need to speak to someone who is experienced in doing regression therapy.
Right, right. That apparently a lot of information came out from your experiences.
Yeah.
So, and I have to tell the listeners that the book is just a marvel. It's a wonderful, it's an emotional book, and it's an eye-opener, and it's well-written. And there's the second half of the book has actual transcripts, which you were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
And they're fascinating to read, you know, because you can see the information kind of emerging as you're, you know, taken under deeper. And it's just, it's a real wonderful story, and it's eye-opening.
It
it's very moving, too.